signing an executive order I consider to be a very important executive order. It's about keeping families together while at the same time being sure that we have a very powerful, very strong border, and border security will be equal, if not greater, than previously. So we're going to have strong, very strong borders, but we're going to keep the families together.
President Donald Trump today signing an executive order ending his policy of separating immigrant families at the border. Trump had repeatedly insisted that only Congress could end family separation. He also said repeatedly that the Democrats were to blame for the controversial policy. Both not true. It was his policy and his policy to undo. The White House was under increasing political pressure to end family separation. Even some major airlines, United, American, and Frontier, said today they wanted no part in transporting children taken from their parents. Trump's decision was an about-face from just yesterday when he defended his zero-tolerance approach to immigration law.
We want to solve this problem. We want to solve family separation. I don't want children taken away from parents. And when you prosecute the parents for coming in illegally, which should happen, you have to take the children away.
Well, here to give us the latest from Washington is John Bennett, White House correspondent for Roll Call. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Well, this is a fast-moving story indeed. Tell us about what's in this executive order. What does it say?
Well, most notably, my first few runs through this document, I do not see any expiration dates, nor do I find any deadlines for Congress. Remember when he signed the order to terminate the DACA program, the president gave Congress a few months to come up with a permanent solution. He has not done that here. So I think that's the most interesting and important thing. This order does not expire. So if Congress cannot find a way to get a bill to the president's desk or to include as an amendment to another bill, something addressing what the administration says led them to implement this policy, then it appears the order would then just have to withstand any court challenges.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the order basically says families should be kept together, but it says they could be detained indefinitely because previously the children could only be detained for 20 days.
That's right. So what this does now is it keeps the family unit together, and it keeps the family unit together while the parents are awaiting a court hearing, because part of this, what it also does is it keeps in place what the administration describes as a zero tolerance policy that all adults who are apprehended trying to enter the country illegally, they try to charge as many as they can process in a certain period of time with a misdemeanor. So now if parents show up with their children, they won't be separated. The children will stay with them while they await that court hearing.
And where are they going to put these families?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question. There is money. They can move money around. Federal agencies have pretty significant leeway, especially ones that deal with national security or these kinds of issues, to move money around. And Congress is involved in that process. But for something like this, we heard a lot of even Republican outrage the last few days once the pictures and the videos of the children came out. I wouldn't expect Congress to block the Department of Homeland Security and the White House if they need to move some funds around. There's money there. There's plenty of money there. But it just might take some tinkering around the edges, and it may take some more money. Congress may have to appropriate new money this year. Senate Majority Whip John Cornyn yesterday said some of the legislation that Republican leaders would like to move, that they've looked at and they're talking about amongst themselves right now, would include probably some new monies, or they would do that with a follow-on appropriations bill later in the year. So this could come with, a $5 to $10 billion price tag. But it doesn't look like there's political opposition to, paying $10 billion or, $7 billion to build some facilities, maybe hire some new, border agents, medical personnel. So it looks like there will be a price tag here, but there's just no political opposition to it. That's at least not yet.
Well, earlier today, Trump had a meeting. It was televised, this meeting with Republican lawmakers. And I just want to play a clip of tape of his exchange with Senator Lindsey Graham.
The dilemma is that if you're weak, which some people would like you to be, if you're really, really pathetically weak, the country's going to be overrun with millions of people. And if you're strong, then you don't have any heart. That's a tough dilemma. Perhaps I'd rather be strong, but that's a tough dilemma.
Okay, so there you have his thinking, I guess, on that. What got him to change his mind and to sign this executive order, do you think? What was the tipping point?
I don't know if there was one tipping point. There was a whole lot of pressure from a lot of different sources. We knew yesterday I was in the Capitol when the president met with House Republicans. Those members came out and told us, multiple members, that the president mentioned his daughter Ivanka Trump had discussed the matter with him, and she was upset about the images and the videos of the crying and just wailing children. And today, the president, when he signed the order in the Oval Office, mentioned that his wife, First Lady Melania Trump, had also discussed it. He said both his daughter and his wife felt strongly that he do something. He also felt a lot of pressure from his fellow Republicans. And there really has only been one issue, despite all of the, shall we call them untraditional tweets, untraditional statements, some of the harsher things he's tweeted and said, even some of the more hardline policies, Republican lawmakers have pretty much stood with him, with the exceptions of the Jeff Flakes and the Bob Corkers and a few others.
Okay.
But on this issue, they are not with him. And on the tariffs, they are not with him. These are two issues where we're finally seeing Republicans push back.
All right. And then finally, we don't know yet. This is not in the executive order. What's going to happen to the families who have already been separated?
That is an unresolved issue. I can tell you that my colleagues and I, we have all asked these kinds of questions today. And, as often is the case when the White House and the president kind of get themselves in a corner, they don't have a lot of answers. But I would assume by the end of the week that the White House and DHS will start to put some policy on the bones, as we say, that they start with the bones and then they put the meat on the bones. They often do things the opposite of the way policy has traditionally been made here in Washington, and it just leaves them scrambling. And I think the rest of the week will be a scramble for them to now write the policy to support what the president decided to do today.
All right. John Bennett, White House correspondent for Roll Call. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
John Bennett is White House correspondent for Roll Call. And after we spoke, news crossed that the Trump administration says they will not immediately reunite the 2,300 children who have been separated from their parents. Trump's executive order is focused on families separated at the border. But immigrant families have been separated in other parts of the country since he took office. For a long time, if immigrants without serious criminal records were arrested, undocumented immigrants, that is, they'd typically be released on bond. But now anyone arrested on immigration violations can be locked up. And sometimes it's for a long time, even if they have a family to take care of. Reed Levinson just published a story about that for Reuters. Hi there.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you. Okay, so in your piece, you tell the story of a woman in Georgia. Her name is Marina Vasquez, 38 years old, originally from El Salvador. She has six kids, all U.S. citizens. And one day she goes out to run an errand. She doesn't have her driver's license because she's undocumented, and she can't get a license in Georgia if she's undocumented, and she gets pulled over. What happened next?
So Morena ended up being transferred from local police into immigration detention, and she ended up spending more than a year in detention. She asked for bond multiple times, and midway through her detention, a judge actually allowed her to remain in the United States legally, but because the government appealed that ruling, she stayed in detention for more than a year.
For more than a year. So what happened to her kids? What happened to her life?
So meanwhile, I mean, she lost the two jobs that she had, and her kids had to relocate in the middle of the school year. They moved to live with their grandfather, who's sick in another town. They had to switch schools and find a place for them all to live.
And how old were they?
They're ages 4 to 7, or they were ages 4 to 17 at the time of her arrest. The oldest is now 18.
Oh, wow. So the 4-year-old, that must have been really tough for that child.
It was. Yeah, it was really hard. And actually, in the middle of her detention proceedings, she was asking for bond, and the kids wrote to the immigration court asking for her release. And the youngest, Kevin, wrote this really beautiful and heart-wrenching letter, totally misspelled every other word, talking about how much he misses his mom and how he cries himself to sleep every night. Mm-hmm. And can they please release his mom from detention?
And again, they were saying that she posed a flight risk, and they refused to grant her bond. And yet she didn't really have a serious criminal record, right? And why would she pose a flight risk if she has 6 U.S. citizen kids who are in school?
Well, she doesn't really pose a flight risk, but the current administration's position is that is to keep people in detention where they wouldn't in other cases. So someone like Morena under the previous administration, under President Obama, wouldn't be considered a flight risk and would have been released from detention pretty quickly. But under the current administration, no one is exempt from enforcement. And so people like Morena end up staying in detention for very long periods of time.
So she spent a year. Is she out now?
She is out now. Yeah, we were there for her reunion with her kids.
Oh, so that must have been quite emotional. What's next for her?
So at this point, she's trying to get her life together again. She had just negotiated a lease before she was arrested for this nice apartment to live with her kids, and obviously that fell through. So, you know, she's trying to figure out, I mean, it's also a transition from detention to then outside of detention, and I think you go through a lot of changes internally when you live through that, and so I think it's going to be a long process getting life back to normal again.
But she could still be deported, right?
Well, she was allowed to remain legally in the United States. So at this point, she's here.
Okay.
She's here legally.
Okay. So you also reported on the general trend, and these kinds of detentions are up. Can you give us some statistics?
Sure. So we figured out that this was happening through two angles, and one of those is that we noticed a surge in requests for bond hearings in immigration court. So requests jumped 38% during the first year of the Trump administration from the previous year to a 2-decade high. And what that means is when people are in ICE detention, if ICE decides not to grant a bond, they can request release from detention from an immigration judge. And so we saw those sort of requests double under this new administration. And we also learned exclusively that ICE has a tool that they use to determine whether or not someone poses a flight risk when someone enters their custody, and also to recommend a bond number. And last summer, ICE changed that tool to no longer recommend release.
And what is that tool?
So it's called the Risk Classification and Assessment Tool, and it's basically an algorithm for taking into account as much information as they have about each immigrant in their custody and coming up with a recommendation for whether or not they should be detained or released, in this case now detained, and a bond amount. And then to be released, to go against that recommendation, an ICE supervisor has to override the tool decision.
So that option is gone now, the release option.
The release recommendation, yeah, is no longer a thing.
So when you're talking about a flight risk, we're not necessarily talking about a risk to leave the country, obviously, because these are people who want to stay in the United States, but a risk that they won't show up for their court dates.
Exactly. Yeah, there's that as well.
But statistically, most do, right, show up for their court dates?
Most immigrants, yes, do show up to their court dates. It's gone down a little bit over the last year, but for the most part, most immigrants attend every single one of their court hearings.
All right. So then is the general idea to try to discourage people from coming here in the first place, this new policy of requiring bonds and incarcerating undocumented immigrants for long periods of time, is the idea that the message will get back to their home countries and to dissuade people from coming here in the first place?
Well, that's what advocates and some immigration attorneys are telling us, that one of the reasons behind having a detention policy like this is that people will find out about it and want to not come, you know, want to not cross the border illegally because of that. And we're seeing that. I mean, we talk in the story about an example of someone who gave up in the middle of their proceedings because they just don't want to be in detention anymore. And we're hearing that on the ground as well. So if that is, you know, the intention, it seems to be working in some cases, but we don't know.
Okay. Reed Levinson, data reporter for Reuters. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, some kids held in immigrant detention facilities are being drugged to calm them down. We'll get the details next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. New filings in an ongoing lawsuit allege that some immigrant children under U.S. custody have been forced to take psychotropic medications. Some have allegedly been injected by force, others given pills, told they were vitamins, and staff allegedly told the children that if they didn't take the meds, they wouldn't be allowed to see their parents again. The facility at issue is the Shiloh Treatment Center in Texas. That's just south of Houston. Matt Smith is reporting the story for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Hi, Matt.
Good day.
Good day to you. So you're writing about new affidavits in an ongoing lawsuit against the Attorney General. What exactly are the new claims?
So as these kids are moved away from their parents, they're put into what's essentially the United States healthcare system, and some of them exhibit what end up being called behavioral problems. I mean, they are separated from their parents and pretty stressed out. And some of those go into facilities for kids with behavioral problems. And what some attorneys did that are representing these kids was go in to one of these facilities and interview kids and get their medical records. And what we ran some of these medical files by an expert on this sort of thing, and that's this sort of thing being forcibly drugging kids, a medical doctor. And he said he looked at medications that are being given to kids that are for schizophrenia and other sort of serious psychotic conditions in order to treat what the prescriptions say is agitation and aggression, just totally inappropriate administration of medications, essentially to calm kids down. That have really bad side effects, obesity that can become diabetes. The kids just want to sleep all day long. One talked about in this statement that she made about her experience in a facility of falling down and hurting herself and being in, so having such difficulty walking because of the medication that she couldn't get up. So that was what we found.
So these are drugs for people who have, let's say, schizophrenia, right? These are heavy duty antipsychotic medications.
After reading the lists of pills and injections these kids were getting, this expert said these are for people who are trying to rip their eyeballs out.
Wow.
It's not for kids that are depressed and anguished because they can't see their parents.
How old are these kids?
Some of the ages on the documents suggested the early teens. So I got the from instances where these kids' statements stated their ages. I got the picture that it was sort of late grammar school, early junior high school age.
And is this happening in just one place, this place Shiloh, or is it happening in other facilities?
So the 420 pages of statements and medical records that they just made public all concerned one place, this already notorious facility in south of Houston. But the claims in the case are that this is a broader problem, that these kids in U.S. custody are being sort of wantonly given really strong, inappropriate medication under the auspices of the U.S. government. So the evidence was regarding this one facility. The claim is that this is a U.S. government problem.
And it's been going on for years now, right? This is an ongoing lawsuit?
The suit is kind of famous because it gets brought up because it deals with mistreatment generally, but this of kids and immigrant kids in U.S. custody. This stuff's all new in the sense that they just got all these kids, these kids that came into the country illegally. They just got their statements, and so the issue of systematic drugging forcibly of kids with inappropriate and really strong psychotropic drugs. This is all new stuff.
Right. Although it was several years ago when Sheila Jackson Lee, the congresswoman from Houston, Democrat, called for Shiloh to be shut down.
Exactly. All kinds of abuses there. The finding of the Houston Chronicle was sort of dealt with the amounts of medication that were being used broadly because they pulled what seemed to have been Medicaid records. They definitely, like I said, have a history of abuse type problems. This sort of shines a light into this very specific situation where there seems to be, if it's not a systematic or blanket policy of forcibly administering psychotropic drugs to calm kids down, we certainly have a lot of cases of this sort of, chemical control.
Mm. And what does Shiloh say about the allegations, if anything?
We placed calls there and haven't heard back. Hopefully, we will, and we'll certainly put it on our stories and on our site.
All right. Well, Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's Matt Smith, reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Coming up, poet Gregory Pardlow's new memoir explores the ways in which he tried to be a different man than his father, who was a labor leader and was fired in that big air traffic controller strike of 1981.
So many times in my conversations with him, there was a sense that, this is the way it is and ain't nobody gonna change it. So, we just got to learn how to deal with it. I just refuse to accept that.
Air Traffic, a memoir of ambition and manhood in America. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
I must tell those who fail to report for duty this morning, they are in violation of the law, and if they do not report for work within 48 hours, they have forfeited their jobs and will be terminated.
In 1981, President Ronald Reagan fired some 13,000 striking air traffic controllers. A few thousand went back on the job. But it was a major defeat for organized labor, and it changed the lives of many of the people who were fired and their families. Gregory Pardlow's father never really recovered. He went from job to job. He lost the family savings. He became a drug addict. Pardlow, a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, has written a new memoir, which is about more than just his dad losing his job in the aftermath. It's really about race, it's about manhood, and what it means to succeed in modern America. The book is called Air Traffic, a Memoir of Ambition and Manhood in America, and Gregory Pardlow is here now. Welcome.
Thanks, Madeline. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Well, can you take us back to your, were you 11 or 12 at the time, your 11-year-old self?
I was 12, yeah.
You were 12?
What you know, it's funny, like? You play that clip, and the one remaining emotion that I can call back up is the feeling of pride, really. My father was a hero to me in my eyes, and I knew, I understood at the time what it took to put all of our lives, all of our sort of security and stability on the line for not only for the job, but for principle, for the solidarity with the other workers. And I was all in with the mission.
Yeah, you were actually on the picket lines with him, right?
I walked the picket lines with him. Yeah, I remember hanging out in the union hall. I spent a lot of time with the men, quote unquote, and had a real sense of esprit de corps identifying with them.
And he was a leader and made speeches and appeared on television.
He grew up as, he was a huge personality, just first of all. But in high school, he was, you know, with the student movement, he had formed with some friends the Black Student Union at Germantown High School. And that was an opportunity for him. It gave him the platform to feel relevant in his community, to feel like he was making a difference. But also, something I understand very, very intimately about my father was it gave him the opportunity to assuage his insecurities and to feed his ego. And so it was a really complex sort of social mission that he had for him, cut out for himself. On the one hand, he's performing wherever he's speaking, is a fantastic public speaker, and he is genuinely invested in, you know, whatever cause it was that he was fighting for. So from the Black Student Union to the labor movement, from civil rights movement to the labor movement, my father slipped right into that that transition really easily. I think it made sense to him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you said your father was a hero to you in your child's eyes. And you ask him what it's like to be an air traffic controller. And he has, or as you remember it or as you write it, an incredibly beautiful way of describing it about keeping the planes as sort of like as ideas. And he talks about ideas as being unique, and you write, some are slow to reach you and sink like jellyfish, while others swoop in like flying squirrels, but they all fit into the same physical grammar. And then he says, in your words, more than anything else, the one rule that matters is spacing, the one true element of the universe, emptiness, incremental negations, putting nothings between somethings. That's what makes order out of chaos. Did he really talk like that and think like that? Because he sounds like a poet. Like you.
Well, yeah, filtered through me, the rhythm of the language and the lyricism of the language is stepped up a bit. But he certainly thought like that. He was a big Carl Sagan fan. We watched documentaries together, science shows together all the time. And he was a fan of the big and imponderable, you know, questions, the unanswerable questions. And so, yeah, that's how his mind worked. But I am sort of recreating or recasting in a kind of more lyrical way his exact words. My father gave me the idea of, you know, the air traffic control being, you know, or the planes themselves being turned into metaphors, you know, turned into ideas or distinct ideas, rather. And I kind of filled in from there.
Yeah. Now, you write later in the book the importance of something in poetry called a volta. Mm. And that is the moment where the pattern is broken and then it sort of makes its point in the poem. Because if you don't have that, then you just have a diary entry, I guess.
As I call it, yeah.
So I guess I'm wondering where the volta is in your life with your father. When was the moment where everything changed and you saw him as you see him now as a more complicated figure, not the hero in your child's eyes?
Right. Yeah. Well, that's kind of the project of the book is because I started out with this idea that the strike itself was the moment of transformation in my life. But it's also, you know, the moment of puberty. So it's a moment of, sort of by default, a moment of transformation. So I began to be really suspicious of that as a narrative strategy. And the more I thought about it, the more I looked at the book as I was writing it as a search for the moment, and if not the moment, then moments of transformation. And so the moral of the story, I guess, what I'm describing in the book about the poem, is that it's not so much important to find, to identify the moment, but it is important to look for the moment. And I think just that process, and what was instructive for me, was just the process of looking back at my life and trying to figure out how I came to, you know, how I grew over the years, how I evolved over the years. That in itself amounts to a life of reflection, right? It amounts to a well-considered life. Hmm. And I think that's the important outcome.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with the poet Gregory Pardlow about his new book. It's called Air Traffic, A Memoir of Ambition and Manhood in America. Well, I guess one of your many voltas in this book, or one of the many moments of realization of who you are and where you came from, comes pretty early on in the introduction, or what you call an introduction. And I was just wondering if you could read a paragraph. It's at the bottom of page 7. And it's Absolutely. It's at a party that your mother has given for you after you've won the Pulitzer Prize. And your father is really in the throes of his decline, and he has diabetes, and he's had to have a part of his leg amputated. So he's in a wheelchair, and he comes in from Vegas to this party. And can you just read this scene?
He came with his motorized chair and his life-extending contraptions to give his final performance. He looked glorious, the old bull, in his matching suede jacket and pants. Determined, he ditched the chair and stood on his prosthesis, no doubt imagining himself in the mode of some hard-bitten pirate declaiming from the quarterdeck. He gave a speech that congratulated me by commemorating his own place in history, situated generationally, as he explained, between two titans, his father and me. We were the giants standing on his shoulders.
And then you go on to say that he doesn't suffer from humility at all. It's interesting that he took your moment to be his moment.
Yeah, he was very good at that. And that was one of the many things that fascinated me about my dad, was how his ego could so subtly transform any moment into, a sort of self-aggrandizing, self-celebratory moment for him. And to him, I'm sure, had I asked him, it would have been entirely generous. I mean, he did fly all the way from Vegas to New Jersey, back to New Jersey, with all, in the condition that he was. It took a monumental effort for him to get there. And so there was his kind of dedication, his devotion to family, his devotion to me, to his sense of responsibility as a father. Everything, all of that stuff was absolutely present. But what was also absolutely present was his sense of his own importance in that moment. Right? I, Greg Pardlow Sr., made this sacrifice. I made it here. I made all of this. I gave all of this the foundation for it to be possible.
But then later in the book, you do talk about the foundation of you. And I don't know if it made it all possible, but you definitely are exploring these, as you call them, four generations of American otherness, and the generations of Black stereotypes that your family has had to deal with. And right. You say that you're not a, quote unquote, practicing Black. What does that mean?
Yeah. So what I'm trying to do there, and I'm very, very aware of how that's going to land as, if not deeply offensive to some people who are, and I think rightly so, and I'm sensitive to it, but I think as a whole, nationally, as a culture, We Americans are absolutely devoted to the structure of race, and I think race itself is a mythology. And we all, you know, I think if we ask anybody on the street, is there anything real to race, you'll get varying sort of responses, but I think we all kind of fundamentally understand that there's that it's a socially constructed. And what I'm doing there in suggesting I'm not a practicing black is I'm making an analogy, trying to draw attention to the sense that the ways in which we perform our racial identities are structured like any other belief system. And it is not a rejection of my sense of heritage and culture and my love for my family to say that I don't believe in the structures of race. That's the kind of bold move, however smartly or recklessly I'm carrying it out. But that's the move I'm trying to make in that moment in particular.
Well, you might not believe in it, but other people do.
I think people do, but the argument that I'm making is that it is a choice to believe in it.
But is it a choice to be affected by other people's beliefs in it?
No. Okay. So now this is here's where it gets really messy and interesting and complicated. Out in the real world, right? And as I move through society, as I walk through a department store or anywhere I come into contact with people who are making assumptions about me, I am absolutely subject to or in negotiation with those assumptions. But there's also a place where I am sitting at my desk and I am writing and I am thinking about who I am and I am thinking about, you know, the narratives, the stories I tell about myself. And in that narrative, it is absolutely a matter of choice what stories I tell about myself. And so, yeah, it behooves me to strategically play into assumptions about what it means to be a middle-aged African-American man of, you know, some middle education. It's also not a foregone conclusion. It is also not a matter of biology. It is not a matter of fate. I guess I believe very deeply in, at least in the influence of free will on the outcomes of our lives, the outcomes of situations that we find ourselves in.
And so does that mean free will to sort of escape the overwhelming oppressiveness, as you've described it earlier, mm-hmm. of your father? You write, my need for his approval would form a crucible out of which I still mm-hmm. struggle to climb. He's mm-hmm. dead now. He's been dead for a couple of years. Are you still struggling to climb out from under that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so I'm not suggesting that it is an easy matter of simply turning off the narratives that we were told at very young ages about who we were. The messages my father gave me about how the world works, about how the world is going to respond to me, I learned those at a very young age, and those messages are tucked deeply away in places where I'm never going to get to all of them. And I also want to say, I don't think the purpose of finding these messages, so to speak, or ferreting out these narratives, I don't think the purpose is to get rid of them. I am absolutely empowered by most of the narratives of what it means to be an African American man in, you know, the early 21st century. I am also very aware that these are the products of cultural imagination. These stories don't form some inevitable narrative about how my life is supposed to go. And I think a lot of that what I'm reacting to and against is my father's deep belief that his story was absolutely already written, and that he didn't. So many times in my conversations with him, there was a sense that, you know, well, this is the way it is and ain't nobody gonna change it. So, you know, we just got to learn how to deal with it. And I just refuse to accept that.
Well, I'm glad we ended on a hopeful note.
I kind of went off there a little bit on a tear, but I mean well. I mean the best. It is hopeful.
I mean, you do say poetry is like a civic duty, so it's not just about, I don't know, inner self-reflection, that you do see it as a civic project and your life as a civic project, I guess, as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
Madeline, it's great talking to you.
That's Gregory Pardlow, author of the new book, Air Traffic, A Memoir of Ambition and Manhood in America. Coming up, what to do with a 6-ton mural removed from Parker Center downtown. It is literally a piece of LA history. It doesn't really have a home now. We'll have that story next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Parker Center here in L.A. is notorious. The former LAPD headquarters was a place where a lot of the controversial paramilitary police policies were codified and carried out. It is also a mid-century building designed by a famous architect, Welton Beckett. Well, now that the LAPD has moved into a new building a few streets away, Parker Center has been slated for demolition, but no date has been set, and preservationists want to keep it. Inside, in the lobby, a significant part of the building was taken down last weekend, a 6-ton piece of art called Theme Mural of Los Angeles. And here to tell us about that mural and the big move is Carolina Miranda. She writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times. Hi.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you back. All right, tell us about this mural. What does it look like?
It is this sprawling 36-foot-long panorama of Los Angeles. And it was made in the 1950s, so it's a very optimistic panorama of Los Angeles. You have Hollywood Boulevard, what was then Mann's Chinese Theater, a freeway with no traffic on it.
What?
Yeah.
That is optimistic.
Exactly. And it offers this very modernist, sunny, you know, this is L.A. This is a booming L.A. It's L.A. of the aerospace industry. This is L.A. in expansion. Era of Los Angeles is captured in that mural.
And it was just freestanding? It was in the middle of this lobby?
It was attached. It is 36 feet long on a series of steel, on like a steel panel held by steel panels and bars. It's a 6-ton mural, so it has this huge frame that supports it. And those were attached to two columns in the lobby of the Parker Center. And so it was no small project to go in and cut away the mural from its supports on the columns into a specially designed steel frame that the conservator John Griswold worked on. It's really a project that's been in the works for years because it was very complicated to move this work of art.
I can imagine. So it all went down over the weekend.
Saturday morning at 7 a.m. they started to take it down, and I spoke with Griswold yesterday, and he was talking about that whole process. They essentially had to build a special steel frame for it to encase the mural before they could cut away the supports. And he said that it was so expertly designed that they expected that once they cut away the mural, that there might be a groaning or a sagging. You know, you never know what's going to happen with a work of art that big when you go and try to move it, but that everything went off without a hitch. They loaded it onto a flatbed, and it is now on its way to conservation treatment.
And where is that?
An art warehouse somewhere in mysterious Vernon, California.
So what will happen then? People will go in and try to repair little nicks or clean it up or
well,
what?
Well, Griswold says that it's definitely in need of a really good cleaning. This was a public lobby. It was a lobby where for many decades people smoked and, you know, were breathing, and a city smog and just all of the pollutants that are in the air have accumulated on the mural. He says that he also needs to examine a number of sections where some of the tiles have gotten a little loose. You know, the grout has started to wear away. You can see it in your shower in the bathroom where your tiles start to look more prominent. He says there are areas where that has happened. And then the whole rear side of the mural is not necessarily a back so much as it is another side. It's also mosaic tile. It doesn't have a pattern, but it used to have this whole embankment of phones, of old pay phones where people could go make their calls at the police station. And that is also made from mosaic tile, and so he'll be treating that as well. So he has, I think, a few years worth of work.
Yeah, and so eventually, what's the plan? Where will it go?
Well, that's the big question, because the city now has to figure out where this is going to go. This is not like a painting that you can just go and hang on a wall or ask a museum to take it. It is 36 feet long and 6 tons. And so there has been, I spoke with Joseph L. Young's daughter, Leslie Young, who
and
has been...
Joseph Young is the creator.
Is the artist, exactly. And she has been very involved in working with the city to try to find a new site for it. Currently, they had been discussing a location within the new LAPD headquarters on First and Spring. And one of her concerns with that is that it's going to go into a ground level area where it's not going to be very visible by the public. It's near the, I understand it's near the permitting office. And so unless you really have business in that area, you're not going to see the mural. And I think the whole point of this mural, the way it was placed in the Parker Center, was that anybody could just step into the lobby and be able to see it. It was a public work of art. There is also talk that once the Parker Center is torn down and a new tower is put in place, that maybe the mural could go in there. Certainly, if that happens, what I would like to see is a space designed around the mural. Again, you know, this is not a painting you hang on a wall. You need to be able to have enough space to admire it. It needs to have some sense of synergy with the decor around it.
What about the airport?
Well, and that's what, and Leslie says they have been in conversations with the city about other possible locations. You know, is LAX an opportunity? Is UCLA? Like, are there other sites around the city in which this mural could go? So they're currently working that out, because it is a piece of LA history.
It is. And we do like to erase our history and move on, but sometimes you need to hang on to bits of it.
Exactly.
To remind yourself.
Exactly. And I think also, you know, what's really interesting about this mural is that it comes in this whole era in Los Angeles in which so many artists were working in the mosaic tile medium. So you had Millard Sheets doing the savings and loans, all the murals that you see on the savings and loans. Charles Kratka and his famous LAX murals, you know, think of that opening scene of The Graduate.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
It's like, what would it be without those murals? And so it's this period in which there was this just explosion of activity in these large scale architectural experiential murals, and that's something that I wouldn't want Los Angeles to lose. Like, we should still have those pieces around.
It's also nice to have a piece of optimism in this world.
Exactly.
Days.
Yeah, we need it. All right. Freeway without cars.
Yay! One can dream. Carolina Miranda, she writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times, and she's a regular contributor here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Christian Bordahl is here now with some listener feedback.
Hey,
hi there.
How's it going?
Well, yourself?
Good. Well, I asked people, we talked earlier, we've been talking so much about undocumented families and how we deal with them. So I asked our listeners, what do you think we should do? You know, what's the best way to handle undocumented families who come across the border? And I got a lot of different answers.
I can imagine.
Doc Mantooth said, deport them faster. Robert McKinney said, we should invest in those countries that people are coming from and help them overcome the issues that are forcing people to leave. So a bunch of different perspectives all the way in between those two. And then I also set out a little Twitter poll asking whether illegal immigration is really a big problem in America. And I got 36% of people saying, yes, it is a big problem. Too many people are coming across the border. 29% said the problem's really not that big. Mostly they contribute to our society. 32% said it's not a problem at all. And 3% said they're not sure. So there you go. All over the map.
Seems like it's evenly split. Interesting. All right, Christian Bordahl, thank you for joining us. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.